Okay, everyone. I'm going to call to order this January 28, 2016 meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. We're going to do housekeeping things to begin with, talking about our schedule and the work plan and that kind of thing. And then we're going to have a presentation from the Department of Corrections about programs inside the prisons. And should be a very interesting presentation. And then, just some back and forth discussion. Why don't we start off just going around introducing ourselves and ending with the people on the phone. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm chairing the task force. I represent District 23 in the Oregon Senate, and I chair the Committee on Workforce and General Government. And to my left is
Julie Parrish, State Rep from House District 37, West Lynn and Tualatin. And looking forward to moving forward on these issues. How's that?
Great.
My name is Brett Yater. I am a mentorship program case manager with Sponsors, Inc. in Eugene, Oregon.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Paul Solomon, Director of Sponsors in Lane County, and Chair of our
Mike Schmidt, Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission.
Robin Johnson, Inclusion Policy Advisor for the Governor.
Hi, I'm Eddie Alves. I'm the Vice President of Academics at Treasure Valley Community College.
Zoe Larmer, staff.
And we have some guests back there. Okay. And then we have a bunch of trainees. Why don't you introduce yourselves? Okay, great, Becky. Yes, of course, Sam.
Catherine,
the assistant.
Jesse Rose, the assistant as well.
Welcome. And then our friends from DOC.
Donnell Meyer, Education, Training, and Treatment Administrator.
Cindy Booth, Reentry and Release Administrator.
Okay, great. All right, well, welcome, everyone. Oh, yeah, on the phone, sorry. Out of sight, out of mind. Okay, who do we have on the phone? Okay, let's start with her.
Charles Neal, Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, Deputy Director, also representing Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors.
Great, welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
Luke Frederick, State Representative, District 23, that's North and Northeast Portland.
Okay. Hello again, Lou.
Andrea Fogg, Legislative and Public Affairs Manager with the Oregon Employment Department.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Jeremy Nichols, Mercy Corps Northwest, Housing Case Navigator.
Okay, great, Jeremy. If you don't know, Senator Winters has had to have a medical procedure that is quite serious, actually, and I think she's recovering well, but it's not clear when she'll be back. But she should be back by the time of our next meeting in March, of course, we wish her well. Lisa Neisenfeld, who is a member of the task force, has left her position as director of the Employment Department, and we have an acting director now of the Employment Department. Andrea Fogg, the Legislative Relations liaison, is here on her behalf. So Zoe, why don't you tell us a little more about what we're doing first?
Mr. Chair, members of the task force, just a couple housekeeping things to get us started today. You have with you a printed out copy of a work plan for the rest of the time that our task force is in existence. Today's meeting will focus primarily on pre-release services, and we'd like to keep that going potentially through the next meeting if there's more stuff we come up with that we'd like to discuss. And moving outward of what happens after people leave the correctional facilities, housing, employment, with the ultimate goal of having a work product ready to go for September legislative days, depending on what the task force is interested in doing. That would mean that we would probably need to have a rough draft of this work product by July so that we could edit in August and have it ready to go by September legislative days. On the left-hand side of the work plan are just some topics I identified in conversation from the last time we met. Probably not completely comprehensive, but a good overview. And finally, I wanted to bring up the potential to schedule meetings for the entire year all at once, rather than you all having to receive thousands of emails from me with different dates and times. Maybe that's something we can discuss more towards the end of the meeting, or an email I can send out after we adjourn.
Well, I think we could, most everyone is here, so we could perhaps start by taking a stab at it, if you're all okay with that. And Commissioner Carlson has joined us. Welcome, Janet. So, you know, we're in the fourth week of January. What do you think about making the fourth week our standard time if we're going to meet monthly? You know, in which case, I mean, does Thursday work? So the fourth Thursday of the month.
Are we going to try to meet in February? Is that
we're not going to meet in February? Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, fourth Thursday is fine.
The fourth Thursday of March.
Works for me. The flu.
Okay, great. So nobody has standing meetings on that.
The 1/4 is the fourth Thursday for March. Is that the week of spring break? Perfect.
It is.
It is for family.
So I'm going to be gone that week. I just noticed that. So.
Okay.
So maybe that one we need to just shift to the
maybe do it the fifth Thursday. Or? That.
Yeah, the fifth Thursday actually won't work for me.
Oh, okay.
Maybe the third Thursday. That for March.
Oh, yeah, that works.
That would put us on the 17th.
Mm-hmm.
The same time frame that we're doing here, 1:30.
1 to 3. Does that?
I've got a lipstick meeting that afternoon.
I would be tempted.
Okay. How about Wednesday? Or Friday?
Yeah, Wednesday's the
16th. Is it? Yes. Not for me, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Members, I would also remind you, you can always call in to these meetings.
Yeah, but I'm going to be presenting at another meeting, so that's going to be helpful. Right,
yeah.
Yeah. And also good the 15th, the Tuesday.
Okay. Yeah. So Zoe will send out an email. We'll try to finalize things. But let's tentatively say Wednesday the 16th. If we can find a time for that first one that is that works for everyone, that would be great. But otherwise, we'll look at the fourth Thursday of the month, 1 to 3. Is the afternoon better than the morning? Yeah. Okay. Great.
Fourth Thursday, not February, and not March.
All right, then. You know, in terms of the work product, are you okay with the basic concept of having the work of the task force go sort of sequentially, focusing initially on the time inside and then moving towards inmates who are transitioning out and then into the challenges that they face in the community? Okay. All right. So can we just spend a few minutes then looking at this this work plan, and is anything not there that, and of course we can keep adding as we go along, but you know, Zoe tried to capture the issues that people touched on last time during the meeting. And do we have an extra one for, yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
On pre-release, I would say, I could just be missing it really quickly, but like some sort of a reach-in from the community that they're going back to. A lot of counties, the community corrections workers reach in and meet with folks before they come out, and also mentors can have that ability as well. So kind of bridging that gap on the pre-release side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so mentorship and reaching in. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we're just anecdotally at least seeing that counties are having a lot of success when the person gets to meet the person that they're going to work with on the outside before they're just released and sent a report to so and so's office. So I know a lot of counties engage in that practice.
Mm-hmm.
So both mentors and
right. Yeah. So is that only true in the county system, or you mean counties reaching in to the state?
Yeah.
Okay.
When our county implemented reach-ins, it went from a 30% no-show rate on that when they're supposed to come out to 3%, just because they knew the person they were supposed to go see.
Mm-hmm.
It's significant.
On pre-release under programs and support, I would love to see us beyond sort of the work type, really heavily focus on like some life skills type classes, personal finance, you know, balance the checkbook, you know, how to access community services, and really try to make sure that they understand, you know, how to reach into services and get what they need, whether it's, you know, OHP or whatever. I know we do some of that, but I really like to see that bolstered, and that's based on feedback from women at Coffee Creek who felt like they were getting close to leaving but maybe didn't have all the skills they needed to be well-equipped
okay.
to successfully
yeah.
transition.
And there may be some of that in today's presentation. Is that right? Okay, good. Yes.
Post-release, and actually this applies to pre-release too, I think it's important for us to remember that so many of the services are driven by assessment, and so much of the work that we're doing these days is really focusing on specific content risk factors. So I think in order for us to really be able to talk about these things, we need to know what it is that we need to be providing for individuals as they're coming out. So at some point, it can be an individual assessment in the list of things that we're doing, because it drives so much of the service delivery.
Mm-hmm. And maybe this will be a question for the corrections, but is that currently something that happens just at the end, or is it an ongoing thing?
It happens in custody, in right. DOC, as well as when you're released by community corrections or agencies and sponsors.
Okay. Great. You know, I realize now as I'm looking at the list that under the pre-release remedies and recommendations, we have state leading by example. And I think what we were thinking about there was the state hiring people after they had been released, making it easier for state agencies to hire ex-offenders. So that maybe should go, you know, under the post-release section.
Question too.
Where it is actually. That's right. Yes, Janet.
And that is the February session's coming up,
mm-hmm.
and a focus of this group is housing. And I know there's going to be a lot of focus on housing in that February session, but we're going to kind of talk about housing after the session is over. We just had a meeting, Marion County folks, because we're looking at developing some transitional housing loosely based on the Roosevelt Crossing sponsors model. And the consultants that are working with us are talking to the folks at Housing and Community Services, and one of the things that they're saying at Housing and Community Services is that they're really not focused on transitional housing. They're focused on permanent long-term housing. And so I'm just a little bit curious how this group is going to interface with the legislation that's going to come up in the February session that's going to shape the dollars that came out of the last session that is supposed to promote housing, or whether, because I'm not sure that, at least in the experience that I've had, and Paul's a much greater expert on it than I am, putting someone when they come right out of prison into long-term permanent housing isn't what works. And so you have to have those transitional housing pieces as a continuum to be able to then move people through the process and then ultimately get them successfully into long-term housing. But if the model of funding that the state is using to expand affordable housing only looks at permanent housing, then we all of a sudden pull out that necessary step. And so then the question becomes, if that decision is made before we finish our work, where is the resource that's going to help the recommendations that we're going to make? Does that make sense? So I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, this is an ongoing conversation around housing, and I don't think anyone has any illusions that we're going to solve all the housing problems in the next month.
But I guess my point would be that if there is money for housing, would it make sense for us to put a placeholder in that bill for reentry housing that might look at a might deviate from the cookie cutter kind of has to be this. So,
yeah. Robin, are you familiar with this issue at all? I mean, the reason I ask is I know that we're going to be looking at a bill that the governor is proposing about, you know, putting sideboards on the allocation for housing that we made last session. Are you familiar with that?
Probably not at the level you're on.
Okay. Yeah, we're talking about that on Monday in the Human Services Committee.
You might just bring it up.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then say, so how does this fit with reentry?
Right.
And if it doesn't at all, and we want to have resources for reentry housing, you know, can we put some acknowledgement of that somewhere in the language that then allows Housing and Community Services to work with this task force in the future, since we're not ready yet? And I think originally, because we were going to have our work plan done by December of 2015, the idea was we would have been ready for that bill in the February session, but now we're not. So.
Okay. Okay, anything else on the list that... yes.
Alternative incarceration programs, or AIP, as a note, and also short-term trans leave, or STTL, are both programs that are used within DOC to kind of get you into that gap, but I think are a big part of the program inside the facility. Mm-hmm. I'd add those to the pre-release list.
Okay. All right. Could you throw that by us again?
On the phone, I can't hear Michael, who you're talking to right now.
Okay.
Is there a way we can get a mic kind of closer to that person?
He's pretty close.
Mayor Zimbro, this is Andrew. If I could make a suggestion, you can tune in and watch it on the computer, or if you have closed circuit like I do at the employment department, and that way I'm hearing everybody.
Okay.
This is the phone mic right here, I think.
Well, yeah.
So my two comments were adding alternate incarceration programs, known as AIPs, and short-term trans leave, STTL, as two pre-release programs.
Great. And as we're thinking about those, Mike, are there problems with those? Are there... You know, are there ways in which, you know, we could improve them?
Well, so I'll talk to the short-term trans leave program. My UC just did an analysis of the recidivism rates of folks who receive short-term trans leave, and found that people who receive it, as opposed to those who didn't, actually recidivate less in the community. And so there's some discussion, at least in community correction circles and other places, about potentially opportunity to expand that program, to lengthen it from 90 days to some other longer amount of time. So it's a conversation that's happening, and I know that it's part of what's used inside to incentivize people to have good behavior, work in programs, and kind of do the things that they should be doing on the inside, and then it seems that that's making them more successful on the outside. So I think it's a conversation that's happening about whether or not they should be expanded. On the AIP programs, I actually don't know as much about those as I do the short-term transit, so I'm not sure, exactly where they need to be or improved.
Okay, well, if they improve recidivism rates, then I think it's something we should talk about. Absolutely. Yeah.
If I could speak on that.
Mm-hmm.
When I went to prison for 22 months in March of 2012, and when I got there after I did the 33 days in Coffee Creek and then went to Columbia River Correctional Institution, I was told that I wasn't eligible for programs because my ACRE score was too low. And I was using prison at that point in time to rebuild my life. I was looking at it in a positive light versus a punishment. And so I was kind of bummed out that they told me just get a job and stay out of trouble is pretty much what they told me. So I wasn't offered the programs, but yet I wanted the programs. And so I don't know if there's a way to offer the programs. I know that the funding is a big issue, but to offer them to individuals who truly want to work that program to better their life, I think that would be important, because I know that there's a lot of gentlemen that sat in my shoes as well that weren't able to get the programs that truly wanted them.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's something also we could get out of the presentation, is how people are selected for the various programs and to what extent their wishes are respected, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, great. Okay, on the phone, anybody have any suggestions at this point for the work plan? And of course, this is all very fluid, and things can and will, I'm sure, be added.
This is Truls. I wasn't at the first meeting, so forgive me if I'm stating something that has already been stated, but I was not seeing anything on here about applying for things like insurance, health insurance. Is that somewhere in the plan?
If there are issues that we need to address, then it should be on the plan, right? I mean, if people are having problems getting insurance, or, you know, problems with the process of applying, you know, this is all about removing barriers where we can. So would you consider that a barrier that people are facing, Truls?
I know that we worked to get inmates signed up for OHP prior to release. I can't speak to what level of problem that is statewide. I know there's pockets of problems in with us, but I'm not always sure where that, who's responsible, who is dropping the ball on it, is what I would say.
Michael?
Yeah.
I would also want to insert something there regarding health and mental health insurance. One of the things that I keep hearing about as well.
So are you talking about health and mental health services during incarceration, Lou, or after they get out, or both?
Actually, both. Yes, both.
Okay, great. Yes, Jen? No?
I actually wanted to say something, but I didn't raise my hand. Thank you for reading my mind. I'm not noticing on here on employment incentives, like on-the-job training. I know the Governor's Reentry Council and Kevin and Dick Withnell are looking at, there's a federal tax credit, that type of thing. But on-the-job training, some of those rules and things are state-driven and locally, regionally driven. So that would be another piece, I think, to look at.
Mm-hmm. Right.
These would be employer incentives for hiring people that have a criminal background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Paul.
I guess I would caution us too about spreading our efforts too thin.
and recognizing that the Governor's Reentry Council is already doing a lot of work on a number of these issues. So I think that at the end of the day, we're going to have to be pretty selective about those things that we actually choose to focus on.
Right.
And also take a look at what other work is already being done so that we're not reinventing the wheel, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important point. You know, I think our goal is to come out of this with some sort of legislative package, and we need that to be informed by the work that the Governor's Council is doing. You know, we don't want to have two separate paths for legislation. Ideally, we'd like to have one and, you know, put the muscle of this committee behind it.
One of the things that, in terms of the size and scope of the list, I serve and co-chair the housing task force that with Jeff Reardon. We've been on that now almost 2 years. And from a group like this, we wound up with 46 or so different things that would actually be individual sort of legislative concepts, and some of them would be packaged, could be packaged together. And we started sort of like, here's the consensus stuff, here's the not consensus stuff, and here's sort of the, where we could get to yes on things. And what we recognized is that there were so many different pieces of the puzzle that it wasn't going to be a one session, here's this big giant omnibus with 46 things, that we would have to sort of break that down kind of over a period of several sessions and keep a little bit of that work group going. So we could say, okay, what can we perfectly flesh out for 2017, and then could we come back in 2018, 2019, and 2020, and over a course of a handful of years, really have well thought out, you know, consensus-based legislation that would let us, you know, come back and keep sort of taking big swipes at the problem. And so, I mean, you'll see bills that come back again in 2017 out of that task force, and we probably have 4 years worth of legislative concepts to flesh and draft and get data for before we actually finish the whole list. So I would suggest that might be, there's a lot on here. To the extent that we can have a nice big package, great. And I'm completely committed to working on this multiple sessions. So
great. Yes. So I assume you knew you were signing on for a 12-year commitment.
12-year plan.
Yeah, thanks for that, Julie. Okay, if there's nothing else on this topic, why don't we move to the presentation from the department? Is that okay with everyone? All right, then. I'll turn it over to Cindy.
Apologies. We are up here so that we can control the PowerPoint for you. So thank you. My name is Cindy Booth. I'm the Reentry and Release Administrator for the Oregon Department of Corrections. And with me today is my colleague, Donnell Meyer. And Donnell is our
Education, Training, and Treatment
Administrator. Thank you. So today we're going to talk a little bit, kind of a high-level overview of some of the reentry services and programs within the Department of Corrections, and happy to delve a little bit deeper on some of the topics that you brought up today, as you may have questions on those, including the Governor's Reentry Council, the Department's Alternative Incarceration Program, short-term transit, things like that. Please don't hesitate to ask questions along the way. So to begin, we'll see if somebody knows how to operate the computer. All right, so.
So are people going to be able to hear her? Okay.
Members on the phone, can you hear this presentation?
It's a little low for me. I don't know. How's everyone else on the phone?
Okay. It's the same. It's low.
Okay.
This is Andrea. I can only hear it because I'm also tuning in separately.
Okay, thank you. I will do my best to speak up. Thank you for letting us know and asking the question. Oh, wonderful. Thank you. All right, perfect. Thank you so much.
How's that? Is that better?
That better?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
So the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division, we're responsible for carrying out the department's mission to reduce the risk of future criminal behavior. And we focus, of course, on the incarcerated prison population, but we are really most successful
when we're working with our partners, our state, federal, local, county, private organizations, the list is long, and our partnerships are very strong, and we appreciate them more than people may realize. DOC targets our resources to those offenders that are assessed at the highest risk to reoffend. So the comments earlier about services that are available to individuals, we are limited both in our funding and in the prison setting in providing the adequate amount of services and resources and programs to individuals. We would love to do more. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in Donnell's piece of the presentation. So this slideshow basically shows the breakdown of the sources of our funding. Department of Corrections has a $1.6 billion biennial budget for 2015-17, and the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division is about $77 million of that. We have general fund, other fund, and inmate welfare funds. So for today's discussions, we're going to talk about three of our program areas: education, training, and treatment, which Ms. Meyer will talk about, programs and services, reentry, and benefits. So this chart shows the breakout of the education, program services, and reentry areas that encompass over $39 million worth of our division's budget, our general fund budget, which is about $67 million. And I'm going to let Donnell talk about the next section.
So education, training, and treatment, as you can see, provides a variety of programs. Our education programs, adult basic skills development, those are moving our inmates closer to attaining their GEDs, and GED often can be a critical part of getting a job, as we know, when they release. Our work-based education, apprenticeship, and training programs help our students actually develop direct vocational skills and offer industry-recognized certificates or college certificates, depending on the program itself. And our substance abuse treatment programs help inmates address their addictions, obviously, and can be significant. Those can be significant impediments to maintaining successful housing and employment when they release. We next slide, Cindy. The programs and services unit is responsible for the overall planning, coordination, and management of the department's behavioral change programs. So cognitive and parenting and the skills-based transition preparation, as well as providing oversight and management to the statewide volunteer. One of the things I wanted to point out when Cindy was talking about risk and how we target our programs to the highest risk, that is not the case for education or the work-based education or apprenticeship programs. We're not necessarily looking, well, certainly not with adult basic education. If you need education, you're going to get it, regardless of what your risk level is. Similar with the work-based education, apprenticeship programs, that's often driven by other factors, including where you're at, how long your sentence is. So those are a few of the programs that are not driven by the risk.
Donna, are you going to provide more information about the education programs?
Not later, but I can talk about it now if you...
So I know that through executive action, the Obama administration has made some changes to the Pell Grant program and allowed certain waivers for institutions to be able to provide college classes that are subsidized with Pell Grants.
Correct.
That haven't been in the institution's hand for over 20 years and pretty much decimated the college programs nationwide. So is Oregon doing anything to get on the bandwagon?
Yes, there's a lot of enthusiasm. I will say, and Mr. Alves knows this probably even better than I do, departments, we cannot apply for that. The colleges financial aid office have to actually apply to be considered for the waiver. So this is a pilot program that will allow for a waiver. All six of our community college partners have submitted letters of interest in participating, as well as a couple of other colleges
I believe University of Oregon also submitted a letter because they do some programming in our Salem institutions. So we've got a lot of interest, and Eddie, if you have anything to add?
No, obviously we're looking at the Oregon Promise as well, which is a waiver for college tuition, and inmates are currently not excluded. However, I'm assuming you're going to talk maybe a little bit about the GED dilemma. If you're not aware, the GED has become significantly harder than it has been in the past, and subsequently our inmates are having all kinds of trouble completing the GED, not just inmates, but everywhere, every college student. So, a matter of fact, I think Oregon Department of Corrections is probably the most successful GED program still in the state, but their numbers are phenomenally low. And in order to be eligible for the Oregon Promise, you also have to have completed your GED. So there's a couple of barriers that we need to work through.
But in regards to the Pell Grant, yes, there is a lot of enthusiasm. The letters were out, everybody's waiting, and we're excited and anxious to hopefully be considered for the pilots for that. And yes, yes.
And it's already been re-implemented for the juvenile facilities.
So how is it going to work in terms of pilots? That there's going to be a select number of institutions that are given this ability?
So it'll be a select number of colleges that are allowed to have incarcerated adults apply for federal Pell Grants through their financial aid offices, and those Pell Grants will be able to obviously pay for the college classes inside the institutions. One of the things I will talk about a little bit later is access to technology, which is one of our enormous barriers. I won't get into that too much, but those two things certainly tie together in a lot of ways. And just to touch on what Eddie said about the GED, he is correct. Our GED numbers are not where they need to be or where they were. Oregon Department of Corrections is, though, probably the best performer in the state, and actually Oregon Department of Corrections has the second highest GED pass rate in the nation for the states that offer GED tests. Our numbers are going up, but it's through sheer will and determination of our educators and our students to move forward.
Can I ask a question on some of the higher ed? You know, are folks in our prison system able to access, like, basically, you're there long enough? I mean, are there programs where they could actually finish a bachelor's degree or finish an associate's degree? I mean, are we allowing that kind of connectivity to our university system? And if so, are we, what type of financial aid are they eligible to get?
So that's a kind of a multi-level question, because we've kind of patchworked, it looks like a quilt of education opportunities, and the answer is they cannot access anything online. So if they are participating in a college program, they're doing it through paper pencil correspondence, and that is one of the areas that we've been talking at the top of our lungs about. We need some secure internet access, because there's only a handful of paper pencil correspondence courses available currently. Chemeketa has done a lot of work with private donors and private donations to be able to fundraise and offer associate's degree programs in the men's institutions in Salem. So they've been successful with that. Outside of that, it's through self-funding and anything that can be done paper pencil. So we try and allow as much access as possible, but without the technology piece, we're hindered, and then they have to pay for it themselves.
And what is driving the technology piece? Like,
so again, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. Then our access to technology, number one, our current inmate network is beyond antiquated, and can't support even the software that I have to buy every year for our educational programs, and again, Mr. Alves knows this very well, let alone support some of the really new technology that could offer the secured internet access. We were given, in the 15-17 biennium, money to replace the inmate network. So we are now in the process of upgrading the inmate network, and once that is done, my hope is I will be able to start to ask
for some of, to pilot and try some of these other pieces that will allow some different access.
And when you, can you describe what the secured inmate network is, and how is that different than just being able to go on the web?
So, and I am not a technology person, so I will do this in the best way I can. We have, our inmate network is through a variety of closed servers, and so all of our different institutions have computer labs that can access these servers, and on that server we put software programs that we use in our education classes. Also, our law library is on the same servers, and they access the same programs. So what we're looking to do is take these servers and this network that we've put together and have it be closed, like it is currently, to operate our programs, but then still have some capability that can do very controlled access to specific sites. Sometimes it's called whitelisting. You can essentially whitelist an internet site that will allow you to go to just that site and nothing else. And there are a couple of examples of some other correctional facilities doing that. And I'm pretty excited about seeing if we can try that out as well once we get our network upgraded.
Can I ask one more follow-on? Because I guess my, I mean, I appreciate that if you, if somebody had full range access to the internet, you know, you can do things you're not supposed to do. But in a sort of a controlled setting of a classroom, to me, it doesn't make sense that we're asking people to be able to transition, but we're not going to give you the full tools that you need in life to transition. So we're going to send you out, maybe somebody who's never seen an iPad before, and we're going to throw you out into the, this new universe of technology. You know, I mean, how hard would it be for us to get to a policy of, you know, because I'm looking right now at the VA's website. You know, if you're a veteran and you're incarcerated and you have a GI Bill, they can pay for tuition, books, and fees and supplies. So, you know, what would it be to say, okay, we're going to let you have a tablet, or we're going to let you have a notebook, laptop, and you have to be able to pay for your own wireless, like a Cricket wireless type system. You leave it in a locker when you're here. You don't get to, you know, schlep it around. You have to come to the classroom. But we're going to let you do this because you've earned the right to go to school, you know, you, as an incentive based in the prison. So I'm sort of trying to wrap my head around, like, why... What is the hurdle to a world that looks like that inside the prison?
Well, I will say two things. I would be remiss if I didn't discuss our facility structures themselves. So when we talk about wireless, which again would be our dream, to be able to have tablets and be able to have people access these things, wireless inside of a correctional facility, especially inside a correctional facility like Oregon State Penitentiary, that's 150 years old, then we start to get into a cost issue because it requires a tremendous amount of upgrading. Where we're saying we're hopeful that this inmate network upgrade will allow us at least to have wired access to some of these things.
But if the inmate paid for their own internet access, right? And so, I've had experience in this because Clackamas County, in their work release facility, actually let us bring in a laptop. They made an exception, let us bring in a laptop. I paid for the wireless card, and there was a controlled room where my sister got to use the computer and full access internet to do her studies, and you know, and she had to maintain the grade while she was there, and the sky didn't fall.
Right.
So in your facilities, in a controlled scenario, if the inmate is willing to provide or has tuition, books, fees, dollars to provide their own internet capability, is it assist? Are you jamming wireless in there? I mean, like the
no.
Tech,
so currently they could not, theoretically currently not get, jamming wireless.
So they could theoretically, though, come in with like an external wireless and a laptop. Mm-hmm. If we made a policy decision that said we're going to trust you to be grown up enough to go to school in this kind of controlled space, and you have to sort of self-provide your $39 wireless card,
I believe that would be a possibility or a capability they would have.
Okay.
I am just going to jump ahead a little bit, and we'll skip it when we get to the slide. But I did talk about the fact that, again, finding jobs, continuing education. I almost inserted into our PowerPoint presentation, there's a gas station by my house that I drive by every morning on my way to work, and they have a Help Wanted sign out, and they've had it out for quite a while. And the Help Wanted sign says, apply on our website. And so to work at this gas station, you have to be able to get onto a website and apply for this job. So access to technology, again, is a huge hurdle and barrier that we are consistently looking for ways of getting over and trying to expand opportunities.
Did you have a question? No.
Well, I'll piggyback on that, if I may, because it fits very well with some of the work that we are doing, albeit hampered. So our skills-based transition and reentry programming, we've referred to it as Road to Success, is designed, it's an interactive mm-hmm. skills training that facilitators work with individuals and groups of adults in custody around employment, how to navigate the employment opportunities that may be available to them, practice interviewing. They're actually videotaped so that they can see themselves and learn from the experience of interviewing over time, how to obtain and keep that employment. So some of the soft skills that are necessary for maintaining employment and making employment gains. Showing up on time, showing up every day that you're required to work, you know, going the extra mile, working out transportation issues and concerns, learning how to work well with others and to take direction from a supervisor, working with their parole and probation officer while they're on supervision and really seeing that person as an ally, someone who can be of assistance to them. Financial management classes so that they can actually learn how to manage their money, whether they're employed or not. Managing stress and practicing self-care, and re-engaging with their family. So it's during a lot of these Road to Success interactions that community corrections agencies and other partner agencies conduct, as Michael referred to earlier, the reach-ins, and they will do group reach-ins as well as individual one-on-one with persons that are releasing back to their county or that have an opportunity to participate in a certain program or living situation when they release to their county. They cover the supervision requirements and some of the county-specific requirements. They can talk with individuals one-on-one, for example, if they're a sex offender, to talk about the registration requirements, the new level system, etc. So a lot of that occurs in those reach-ins, and we do schedule those regularly. If it can't occur in person, which is preferred, then we do arrange for them to participate by phone or video connection if the county has that available to them. But expanding reach-ins is something that we're always looking to do, and making that available time and context is important.
So Cindy, the Road to Success, is that limited to, you know, the time just before their release, or, you know, who's eligible for that? When does it happen?
Sure. Anybody is eligible, and they can select to take all the classes that they want to on any topic, or they can select just certain ones that they believe that are necessary for them. It's targeted to the last 6 months of their incarceration because it's an opportunity for them to practice in those settings some of the skills that they're learning. We also have very limited, talking about technology barriers, very limited access to identified websites for people to use a standalone computer. It's a touch screen system. It's very locked down, literally and figuratively. They can apply for, they can use the iLearn system. They can use the iMatch system through the Oregon Employment Department. And some of those types of websites, but we struggle more and more with that antiquated equipment and access to keep it operational. But the goal was to help them learn some ways of navigating the websites that would provide information and community-based resources and services information to them before they released from incarceration. So that's something that we're in our information technology explorations hoping will benefit from.
Okay. And so is that something that's available in all institutions or just for a small fraction?
The access to information is available at all institutions. The Road to Success classes are available at 9 institutions, 9 of our 14, and there are primary release institutions. And so those are DOC staff that facilitate those classes and highly skilled to be able to do that. And a little bit later, I'm happy to talk about, you know, some of the work of the Governor's Reentry Council and some of the things that do seem to dovetail that perhaps we can talk about in more detail that support these efforts.
So this table outlines our 6 work-based education programs and includes the capacity numbers, where they're offered, the community colleges that we work with to offer those programs, and what the outcomes are. The curriculum of each program aligns with industry-specific skill sets, and the number of participants in the program are driven by several factors, one being space constraints, and another one being the teacher-to-student ratios. So for our cosmetology program, her license will only allow her to have 20 students, so we have 20 students. So it depends, again, on some of the licensing. So there are currently 8 apprenticeship programs and 2 training programs that we offer within the Department of Corrections. We have a strong and collaborative relationship with the Bureau of Labor and Industries and have had for many years. And Boley's willingness to assist our department's process has not only made it possible for us to be able to offer all of these programs, but it's really helped us to flourish and offer more and more. So we're constantly working with Boley to look at ways we can expand different opportunities. The HVAC program just was approved last year. That's a new one we were able to add with Boley. And again, through our partnership, we added the training programs. And the training programs differ from apprenticeship programs in that they have some slightly different restrictions on supervision. So there's a less strict journeyman to apprentice ratio, and they're shorter duration. So it allows us to actually do some work in the minimum facilities where the adults in custody aren't there as long and maybe aren't able to do a 6,000 or a 4,000-hour program, but they can do a 2,000-hour program. So it's, again, our partnership with Boley that has really allowed us to be able to expand, and we're constantly looking at ways to add more. We're trying to find right now, we have a gentleman working very hard to find a culinary program that we can do, again, with our Boley partners.
So, you know, one of the hallmarks of apprenticeship is that you earn while you learn. So are people in these programs actually getting wages for the work that they're doing?
It would be their job. That is their job, and they are doing it like they would do an apprenticeship in the community. They're working with a journeyman, and there are electricians are out doing electrical work and having that signed off. We track all of their hours, again, with Boley, so those hours are official and tracked. They leave with those same licenses. Same with the training programs. That was the other piece. When we were looking at training programs, we were trying to find jobs that were already happening in the institution. So essentially, we took things that they're already doing and found ways we could provide some structure, some independent study, and track those hours to make it official and approved by Boley. So, yes.
Okay. And remind me, we had a bill last year to fix a problem. Was it last year or the year before? What was that? Do you remember?
Yeah, you sponsored legislation to allow individuals who released or were on supervision in the community and had DMV fines or fees.
Yeah, no. This is no. What I'm thinking of is different. There was something related to the teachers in the
licensure. There was an underground education licensure for people with sex offense convictions, prostitution. There was an issue with a woman who had gotten her master's degree, had a prostitution conviction, wasn't able to teach. There was something that came up around that.
And I also know that OYA, Oregon Youth Authority, had some legislation passed that allows them to work similarly to how we work with Bureau of Labor and Industries.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was.
So that I know happened last legislative session.
I have a question about the all the different apprenticeship programs. I mean, my experience has been that people who come out with certifications are very employable, and some of these are really valuable programs, but they're very limited in scope. So I just want to kind of contextualize, how many slots are there in total out of the 14,000 people in custody? Is the only thing that keeps you from expanding these resources? I mean, I heard you say that in one case it's, you know, a person can only have so many people that they're supervising. But my understanding is that the main reason we don't have more of these programs is that you just don't have the ability financially, because they're, some of them are expensive.
I would say that is much more the case with our work-based education programs. We would really love to be able to offer many more of those, but those can be very expensive. Our apprenticeships are limited on that journeyman to apprentice ratio. So we have to have It's Department of Corrections employees, so that's the other thing. They can't be supervised. If I'm an inmate that comes into the system with my journeyman electrician card, I can't supervise apprentices. It has to be a DOC journeyman electrician, and then sometimes it's a one-to-one ratio. So even if we had five people, we can't match up the requirements. So that's really what limits us in a lot of these. And to be honest, the number of hours, the HVAC is 8,000 hours for a full apprenticeship. So in order to be able to do that, you have to have a very long sentence. So it also is a bit limited in that capacity. That's the reason we looked at the training programs, to try and find something that would allow a little more flexibility in our ratios. The training programs can be up to 5-to-1 in student to journeyman, and again 2,000 hours, so it's a little more flexible.
So in those long hour programs though, so the programs won't allow them, so let's say you're 2,000 hours in, they come out and finish the other 6,000 hours? I mean, is there a path to, you can finish this up when it
certainly
them sooner?
Yes, certainly. There's, again, that's why we work so closely with BOLI. Those hours are your hours, okay. And you can get out, and they apply exactly where you're going. If you get accepted into that union, they're there. However, we work as an agency, because it is such an investment, we work very hard to not have them move until they're done. So, because coming out with it, again, like Mr. Solomon said, coming out with it, it's almost, I would say almost all of our journeyman electricians have a job as soon as they get out. So it's very beneficial if they can finish it up while they're inside, and we work really hard to make sure that happens.
And how about the other programs, the the work-based education programs? Do you have statistics on how employable people are as they're coming in, how many of them are able to work in their fields?
That is one of the areas of improvement that we were also going to speak with you about. That is a piece of information that we get asked on a continual basis, and it is very, very difficult for us to track once they're out. And
that's true for the colleges as well.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we hope so, and in some ways we get information. Again, I'm not meaning to completely highlight our cosmetology program, but one of our graduates is actually coming back in to speak to the current students, because she got out, she started working in a salon, and then she bought her own salon. So we do hear that they get out, they find employment, but we're looking for partnerships and resources in order to track that better, so that we can show where we're having an impact in a meaningful way. But so far, it's very difficult.
Yeah, and I could speak to that a little bit. Department of Corrections has been working with the Employment Department the past year and a half to figure out ways that we can share data and identify individuals who have gained employment post-release, get wage and hour information, and learn whether or not they make gains in their employment over time. And part of that requires that the person give us permission to use their Social Security number for matching purposes.
And so that's one of the hurdles that we do face, because not everybody would be willing for that specific purpose to allow us to use our Social Security number. But we are also working with Employment Department out of the Reentry Council efforts to issue work opportunity tax credit confirmation letters as people release from prison. So it will be a document that's available to the individual and their prospective employer, and we'll also have a copy available to the parole or probation officer to have on file. It signifies that the person has released from prison and they meet the requirements of a work opportunity tax credit under the ex-felon category under the federal regulations. And so this is a tax credit of close to $2,500 that the employer is able to apply for, and the Employment Department processes those quite regularly now, and it's a quick turnaround. And then we also are working with them on the federal bonding program. So there's a $5,000 federal bond that employers can apply for to cover the ex-felon category as well. So those are some education efforts, as well as providing information beforehand to both the individual and the employers. So I'll talk just briefly, and then we can go into more detail as you have interest around the reentry and release services. So DOC provides reentry and release planning for individuals that are housed in DOC's 14 prisons, as well as those that we house at the Oregon Youth Authority. As of today, we have 307 young inmates housed at the Oregon Youth Authority. And we also do release planning for Oregon inmates that are housed out of state and for persons that are housed in our state serving a concurrent sentence. The Reentry and Release Unit also coordinates the Governor's Reentry Council, which I'll speak a little bit more in detail about in a moment, and reentry benefits for persons that are releasing from prison. And I know that this is a hot topic because of the Affordable Care Act. Medicaid expansion beginning January 1 of 2014, we began in earnest in February of that year, so 2014, to help persons apply for Medicaid, or the Oregon Health Plan as it's formerly known, prior to their release from prison, so that their benefits are in effect the day they release. They cannot receive that benefit while they're still incarcerated, but it is effective the day of their release, and we are at a point where we're actually sharing what their Medicaid prime number is with the individual and their parole officer, and we're posting it in our chronos so that people can access that information and use it when they seek health care services in the community before they actually receive their Medicaid card in the mail. And then for persons that are age 65 and older, they are eligible for traditional Medicare, for lack of a better term. It's based on their income and assets. It's a different eligibility test and process, and it takes longer for that process to occur. If it's under the Affordable Care Act, we have about a 30-day window of opportunity and a very quick two-day turnaround. The traditional Medicaid is about a 90-day window of opportunity, and it may be very close to release before we know the answer to whether or not they're eligible for those Medicaid services. But having those services in place is critical with regard to transition planning and that continuity of care, whether the individual does or doesn't have medical or mental health concerns. And I'll talk in a minute a little bit more in depth about some of the connections we make with regard to ongoing physical and mental health care. Our unit is also responsible for post-sentence reports. The short story on that is post-sentence reports are written for individuals who are required to have a pre-sentence report for the Board of Parole to consider their parole requirements. So traditionally, it's the ag murder cases. And if a pre-sentence report was written by the county, prior to them coming to prison, we use that. If none exists, then the parole board requests a post-sentence report. And then state-issued identification. Our unit also works on ensuring that people have state-issued ID to the degree possible when they, before they're released from prison, using a valid with previous photo law that is in effect for Oregon's prison system. We apply as a Department of Corrections and pay for individuals to have a birth certificate on file, and we apply for Social Security replacement cards 180 days prior to release. We have a memorandum of agreement with the Social Security Administration to actually process those statewide. We also have a DMV trip process. Since 2009, we've been able to transport 10 inmates. We're now up to two prisons, Deer Ridge and Madras, and then one of the Salem prisons, Santiam Correctional Institution. These individuals can obtain their original identification card. We focus on actually taking on the trips individuals who have no Oregon DMV record. If they do have an Oregon DMV record, then we use a valid with previous photo opportunity, provided it's not too old. If it's 9 years and 2 months or past that, then DMV won't retain the record. But through that process, we're actually able to issue the renewal ID or replacement, renewal driver's license or replacement, or original ID card if their driver's license is revoked or suspended. So it's a good opportunity. And currently, the Department of Corrections does pay those costs as well. So our birth certificate efforts, we have increased dramatically our ability to get those. We began focusing not only on the reentry population, but also those that are age 65 and older. We apply to each individual state using their application, paying their fee, and we most recently found that we have up to 33.88% of our population with those cards. One of the, so many things are interconnected. Donnell touched on the fact that having ID at release is critical for finding employment. It's also critical for getting housing. And in many ways, it's critical for some of the benefit streams for which people are eligible. Medicaid for persons age 65 and older, having a certified copy of a birth certificate is critical because the Centers for Medicaid Services will not process an application request until it's received a copy of their birth certificate. And so for some individuals in our custody, because we have some up to in their 90s in age, finding a birth certificate can be very challenging. But we go to the ends of the earth to be able to do that, because access to those funds and offsetting state general funds is really critical post-release. So in brief, we process about 300 age 64 and younger applications every month, and we focus on obtaining Social Security benefits and Medicaid for 65 years and older to those who have a serious medical or mental health condition, and we're working with Social Security daily on those applications, and we're pretty successful. But a lot more can be done if we had more staff to deal with. We also, yes?
You know, this would be an issue that I would actually put on if it were not for the fact that the Governor's Reentry Council has a committee that's working on aging population. Right now, Oregon has the highest concentration of over 55 inmates in the country, and it's a huge challenge for us meeting the needs of the seniors that are coming out, particularly specific subpopulations like sex offenders that are coming out that have, you know, really high medical needs. They can't get in their facilities anymore in the state. So there are a lot of issues associated with meeting the needs of the aging population. But it is good that there is a group that is beginning to kind of
Thank you. It is very critical. We're facing every day problems with finding appropriate housing locations and services, wraparound services. DHS comes to the table and fully engages, but they too lack often the resources that are necessary or the funding that's necessary for the amount of time needed for to stabilize that individual and potentially move them into a different care setting. So,
do you have any, not today, but yes, maybe some demographics of, you know, what are those ages, how close are they to the end of the sentence, so we sort of get a sense of how many people we're talking about. Are we talking about 10, 90-year-olds mm-hmm. or, you know,
sure.
70, you know, 65-year-olds? That'd be interesting to sort of see yeah. a breakdown of just, you know, overall demographics mm-hmm. of what that, and by gender mm-hmm. and things.
Sure. Happy to.
And how close some of those people are to sort of transitioning to releasing out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Happy to, yes. And actually, the aging populations group, which Paul serves on, is looking at individuals who are ages 50 or older, because the incarceration population tends to be, in terms of their health situation, in more dire situation than folks on the outside. So we'll talk about that. Thank you for asking. Talk a little bit about transitional housing at release. Commissioner Carlson at the beginning of the meeting was talking about how important that is, and how evidence is showing that individuals need a step down opportunity from incarceration to finding housing appropriate for themselves and their family if they reunite. So transitional housing opportunities are typically those that are subsidized by county community corrections agencies through funding that they receive from the legislature through the Department of Corrections, as well as programs such as Sponsors in Eugene that relies heavily on grant funding and donations and other such funding opportunities. The transitional housing options for Oregon vary greatly and dramatically from county to county. Some counties have partnered with nonprofits or faith-based organizations and are able to provide temporary transitional housing, and that's usually about 30 days worth, with or without programming, or without those wraparound supports and services. And then other counties can provide only emergency shelter options. And several are virtually without resources, and as a result, those who release from incarceration end up being homeless.
And Cindy, this ties directly to short-term trans leave
yes.
and AIP, yes. because you can't take advantage of those if you don't have housing
right.
to go to. So we have had AIP participants who were not able to secure housing in their county of release and were not able to leave. Right.
I think this is an important issue for this body to look at, is kind of the geography of housing in the state, because you're absolutely right that it varies greatly from county to county. And if you get outside of the valley, the resources are pretty slim in smaller counties, and part of it has to do with the scales of economy, but part of it has to do with resources too.
Yes.
But there is really a lack in some places of transitional health. There's just not.
And so do those people tend to move then to Portland, Eugene, whatever?
They can't.
Yeah.
But they can.
Right. You have to go back to the county that you came from.
Yes, the law requires a return to their county connection, county record.
Okay. And I mean, is that something we should be looking at? If they're not getting the kind of support that, I mean, not that.
Well, I don't know if Senator Winters would love that idea.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know. It's.
I think it's something we should look at. I think the challenge is the counties get money to pay for services, and some counties invest more heavily in these type of resources than others. So I don't think we would want to open the doors and penalize those counties that have spent their invested more heavily in these resources to subsidize the services for the other ones. And I think you would want to, if you do that, you would want to set up a structure whereby those counties got additional funding for taking on people from other counties.
The other thing, and again, not to take over Cindy's piece, but this can also be especially problematic for females, for women releasing, because you may have 5, 10, 15 men, so a county might be able to provide some resources, and you have one woman. And I again would say women can have some of the more complex issues when it comes to county transfers, because maybe their children are located there, and it doesn't make sense for them to move out of that county. So just something to keep in mind, that that does impact in, again, some of those smaller counties.
And if I could add two, a couple of points. One is that there are resources for support through tenant-based assistance that we've looked at, and there are some barriers to tenant-based assistance in terms of, I think, the administrative costs can't be paid out of the grant, something like that. And so there have been some struggles around that. The second thing is that there's a variety of quality in these housing situations. So oftentimes we're so desperate to find a placement for somebody that you don't tend to worry as much about whether it's a quality place or not. So, and I'll probably say some things that will offend somebody in this comment, but Oxford houses, for example. So Oxford houses are, there are a number of them in Marion County. Some of them are good from what I hear. Some of them, people, drugs and that type of thing. They're supposed to be alcohol and drug free, but they're not necessarily guaranteed to be alcohol and drug free. And then there are also nonprofits that will set up transitional housing, and they'll have really good intentions and really big hearts, and they want to do something, but they don't have the business skills or the acumen or whatever to be able to manage it appropriately, and then the facility goes away, or, you know, it's in disrepair or whatever. And so I think if we're looking at this issue, we also want to kind of set some criteria maybe for what constitutes a quality setting for someone. We did a timeline, actually, in Marion County. We did this probably more than 10 years ago, that a flow chart, actually, that showed, okay, from the day of release, what should happen, and someone should be signing up for Section 8, you know, like on the day that they're out, because it's going to take them a year before they get on it. And then here are the options that they could have: tenant-based assistance, transitional housing, what the optimum would be in terms of moving people through. I could provide that if you're interested in seeing that, but it's a real struggle. So it's not just, and if you can't find a quality, even if you can't find a quality place, a lot of people end up in shelter anyway, because we have so many people in Marion County that we don't have enough transitional housing for everybody. So,
and it's an excellent point, because some counties have reported to us that even if they had all the money in the world, they couldn't secure housing in their locations, other than buying or having something built that they operated themselves. Mm-hmm. So the needs around the state vary greatly and are significant. Yeah. One of the things that perhaps we could share information regarding, and you'd find that helpful as well, is the Governor's Reentry Council, when they were working on that transitional housing grant, actually developed a template for standards and of what should be in a transitional housing model, along with a menu of suggested services that can be applied as appropriate to whatever the county or local organization's needs are. So it's a transitional housing opportunity with wraparound services and supports that actually are geared to help the person be successful and then transition from that to more permanent housing opportunities.
Cindy, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't there also kind of a legislative concept that was drafted along with that, that at the time didn't go anywhere for lack of resources, that would have incentivized counties that spent money on transitional housing by providing a match?
Yes.
So for those counties that invested some of the grant made money in transitional housing, there would be a match, and that might be something else to share with this group, because it was a good idea, it's just bad timing.
Yeah, it was difficult timing.
Mm.
Yeah, it was around 2008.
Yeah, yeah. No, that would be good.
Okay.
That would be good to see.
Happy to do that.
And so the you know, the policy that we have, where offenders have to go to the committee, to the community, where they, is that standard around the country? Is that standard practice? And I'm just wondering, are there other states that use models where the housing dollars follow the inmate, or you know, as opposed to it sounds as if they go to the county.
I think in many states, full information is run by the state.
Exactly.
Counties, resources flow a little differently. So Oregon is different in that regard. I guess that would be my main
I worked in Washington State, and they're not required to go back to the county of conviction, but Mr. Simon said, they're a unified group, that probation and parole in here. It's, again, it's a little more sporadic.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. So to talk...
I'll be chewing on that one for a while. But yeah, thank you.
To talk a little bit more about the individuals with high physical and or mental health needs at release. Undoubtedly, many of them require a nursing home level of care or adult foster care type of setting, and the aging populations team of the Governor's Reentry Council is exploring options and funding sources that do include federal funding to offset general fund costs. But more importantly, the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors, and the Association of Counties Mental Health Programs have a memorandum of understanding. This is our third biennium of that understanding. It's around case planning and case managing of individuals with serious mental illnesses. And it outlines protocols that the state, the counties, and the mental health programs will follow to do interactive case planning for individuals pre-release so that they have continuity of care as part of their release planning. And through that memorandum of understanding, we've actually been very successful in ensuring people have ongoing medication management and other supports needed so they're more successful in the community. And it's important to remember that a lot of these individuals have burned bridges and outstayed their welcome in the community. So when they're returning under a case management process, the community is much more understanding and receiving of them and are helpful with regard to their medication management and housing concerns. So we found that memorandum of understanding very important. Thank you very much. We've talked, I think, about this in more detail in earlier conversations, but again, we're doing a better job of securing those documents necessary for obtaining identification, getting folks on health care plans before they release, and ensuring that Social Security benefits are available to them as well. And then finally, there was some discussion earlier today about veterans benefit. I believe, Representative Parrish, you mentioned that one in a web search you were doing. And there is an incarcerated veterans task force that was established by House Bill 2838 in the 2015 session. And so that task force is taking on a lot of work around this topic. But we do have a long working history and collaboration with both state and federal Veterans Administration to ensure that individuals have access to information and benefits while they're incarcerated, that their benefits can be apportioned to family members. And through this task force, a lot more work is underway to actually move that to the intake process and do a better job of identifying individuals as veterans and helping them to get changes to their discharge status if it's appropriate and they are eligible for that, so that we can get the benefits flowing sooner rather than later.
And I sent Zoe to ask her to disseminate. There was an NPR story this morning about the VSO program in the California prison system, and it's actually run by inmates. Where we've been searching for like dollars for a staff person, their VSO, they've actually trained inmates to be the VSOs. And the dollar figure that they used was, or the numbers that they shared were that they've reached 1,000 inmates through the California system and have drawn down $15 million in annual benefits back to those inmates and their families. So So that's one of Paul's big, Paul Evans says that. Our goal has been to try to get a VSO connected to the prison system, but their model's different. It might be possible for us.
Yeah. And we have county veteran service officers that come into prisons now. And I would say that the Snake River Institution, the county veteran service officer there is probably, you know, the gold star representative, because they practically live at the institution providing services and do have some inmate type of VSOs, but they don't have the power of attorney that is often necessary for the benefit determinations. But it'll be interesting, and I think a lot of good work is going to come from Representative Evans's task force.
Are you tracking the number of veterans in as they come in? Have you ever, we've got to have done a census?
We do. However, it is self-report data.
Okay.
And so what we're hoping to do is we need to figure out what is really true versus what is what the person believes is true or what they wish to report. And we are able to access the Veterans Reentry Search Service, provided, again, that the individual lets us use their Social Security number for that purpose. And they're not always willing to do that. Certainly at intake, they're a little leery of sharing more information than they wish. But we are working on that, hoping to make progress. So if I may, just briefly in closing, I'll cover a little bit of the Governor's Reentry Council work and just to give a framework for that effort. There are 7 implementation teams underway, and we've talked a little bit about a few of them. Aging populations. So they are looking to explore and create system improvements concerning persons needing long-term care services and supports, persons needing self-sufficiency and support services, making sure that they have those personal supports and care provisions outlined, care infrastructure and frameworks are in place locally to provide services upon release, and also exploring the Older Americans Employment Act so that individuals who are ages 55 and older have opportunity for part-time or full-time community-based employment. Business community is looking at available jobs and needed skills to qualify for those jobs, including soft skills, educating employers as to hiring the reentry population and the incentives that are available to them. Statewide leadership by example, you referenced earlier, challenging those state agencies and organizations that serve on the Governor's Reentry Council to hire the reentry population now that Ban the Box legislation is through, you know, talking with DAS, HR, and others about state agency barriers to hiring people with a background. And then messaging reentry statewide, actually building a toolbox for communities and employers to figure out which pieces of the strategy will work for them. There's an education team that is looking to ensure education gains made while incarcerated are actually transferred to the community-based education supports and streamline that process. Pre-release inmates should have effective access to high school and post-secondary educational programs so they can complete post-secondary certifications or degrees during incarceration. And again, Donnell talked about that earlier, IT being those technology supports being critical to that. They're also looking at establishing a credentialed, stackable, and universally transferable education that's available to all correctional facilities, not just those with whom we may contract for a service.
And who's working on that?
The education team of the Governor's Reentry Council.
Mr. Alves is part of that.
Yes, Mr. Alves is part of that. Incorporating educational planning as part of pre- and post-release inmate planning, and funding strategies that mitigate the costs of delivering and enrolling in inmate education. So some of the same things, Pell Grants, the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and other opportunities for successful education completion. The Family and Community Connections team, in brief, they are working on dynamic family and support system survey. So this is a survey where the family tells us about what they believe their support system looks like and how that may change over time, so that we can engage those supports to be part of that person's life during incarceration. Statewide resource inventory, and we're actually working with 211, who has both telephone, texting, emailing access to take over the reentry wiki information and actually help people triage when they call or access their website if they're interested in reentry topic. Mentoring of justice-involved adults, so developing a mentoring hub to actually manage mentor matches, standards and criteria for mentoring persons who are in the criminal justice system. There's a focus on juvenile reentry, specifically the DOC youth that are housed by the Oregon Youth Authority, making sure that their transition from prison to the community is seamless and that the benefits and resources that they had opportunity to at OIA actually carry through to the community. And then veterans reentry, which is being coupled with that task force on incarcerated veterans. And the last one is around sex offender level system. So the 2515 legislation the Board of Parole is implementing, doing employer, inmate, and family education about what is true and not true about that law. And that's a high-level overview.
Yeah. I wonder if you could provide that for us.
Absolutely.
I mean, that would be really useful.
Yeah.
Great. So, you know, with respect to that issue around leading by example, do we have a sense of which counties are doing well, which cities are doing well? I mean, is there the capacity to have an inventory of where we are on that in terms of public agencies? Is that something that it would make sense for the legislature to request? Or is that something that you can get at? Or not to put a burden on our counties.
Starting to ask the questions, but I think it is a bigger question than just a poll or a survey. If I may defer to Paul to respond in part to what some cities and counties are doing.
Yeah, I think it's possible. It's a little tricky. I mean, there are funding streams, like there's the grant and aid money that flows to the counties that is often used for reentry services, and the counties are required to report in the community corrections plan to the state how they use that money. Additionally, the $3,194 that are coming to the counties have similar requirements. So there's a method of at least extrapolating from community corrections plan, and I would defer to Mike about the 3194 funding, about how much of that resource is being used for reentry related activities. But that's not all. I mean, so for example, Multnomah County uses general fund money to fund certain projects. Lane County sponsors gets 3194, we get grant aid money, but we also get quite a bit of federal grant money. So I think it would require some type of statewide pull through the community corrections agencies would probably be my best guess, because they're the ones that can have their finger on the pulse of what's being spent and what's available in their counties. But it would be a worthwhile activity,
for sure. In terms of leading by example, from a different perspective, those I know that City of Eugene, Multnomah County, they have basically banned the box, so to speak. but I don't know if we have a way of identifying the number of individuals that would otherwise be have a barrier to employment prior
to. Was
that
the question?
Yeah, it actually was. We were talking about leading by example in terms of local governments, colleges, you know, public educational institutions, et cetera.
Hiring.
To what extent are they hiring ex-offenders? And in that way, leading by example. Yeah, but yours was a good point, too. And, you know, I'm just wondering if that information is readily available or is reported in some way, and if counties, for example, would freak out if we were to require them to
Well, didn't Ban the Box actually pass in the legislature?
It did.
It did.
Right. It did.
With and some exceptions, right?
Yes.
Right.
And it's, you know, one, it became effective January 1. So one of the difficulties is to know, you know, not enough time yet has passed to know if that legislation has been effective across the board. But we do know, and DOC is one example, we do know that state agencies have and continue to hire individuals with criminal backgrounds or would otherwise have been seen as a barrier to employment because of their incarceration. And part of the discussions of the team, the business team, have been to have a conversation with DAS about what are, you know, state HR regulations that are prohibitive. But it is, you know, they are the state's HR, human resources agency, and that's one starting place. But then for cities and counties, it would be a similar conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Our ability to match that kind of information with employment department has its limitations because not everybody indicates that they, you know, are a felon, for example, in the IMATCH system.
Mm-hmm.
We do have some information about employment of persons with who are ex-felons under the Work Opportunity Tax Credit. So if the employer applied for a tax credit, whether or not it was granted, then employment department does know those numbers. But it's based on a year, calendar year.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some ways to get to it, but I don't believe it answers fully your question, Senator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the place to start really would be with the state, and to try to get a sense from the state through DAS of how many ex-offenders they're employing and how that has perhaps changed over time. Because we are, you know, when we passed the Ban the Box legislation, you know, we were asking that to apply to private employers, right? And so we want to make sure that we are, you know, doing a good job, and not just by banning the box, but by actually hiring people.
Yes.
I think it would be helpful to look at, one, how many people are actually applying for jobs. I think one of the challenges that has existed by having those questions on applications is it deters people from actually applying. So two questions I would ask is, are more people from criminal industries applying? And then how many of those people that are applying are actually getting their foot in the door?
And also, it seems like there's an opportunity to educate particularly HR managers. I know there's an HR managers group that meets in Salem regularly from different folks. And we went out early on in the reentry initiative and went out and met with different like all the food processor folks worked together through the Jobs Council and different sectors meeting and just kind of explain what's possible, because there's the law, and then there's what HR people kind of layer on top of the law, and it gets all mixed up in people's minds where they think that the law says they have to do something. And then there's also kind of the how we've always done it and the discomfort with change. And so I think people need to have good information. And then it's also true that there are, it's not a one size fits all. So there are certain professions in the government sector too, where people who have been convicted of certain crimes can't have those particular types of jobs, whether it be handling money or confidential positions or law enforcement positions where certain certifications are required and that kind of thing. So I think it's a, you know, ban the box, and whether you get your foot in the door is that's important, but then whether you actually get the job, you know, in there is the most important thing. And there's still a lot of misinformation, even if we ban the box at the outset. It just means more people get interviews, but are the public opinions still such that HR people are going to be screening out people just in a different, just later on in the process? So I think all of that needs to be analyzed.
And do you as a government, employer have any issues around hiring felons of, like, because like bonding or insurance issues for your workforce? Because that sometimes that is something I've heard from employers is, you know, my bonding rating changes if I bring in somebody who's a risk.
Yeah, I haven't heard that. But I do know that initially, and I think I might have told the story last time, so if I did, I apologize. We had a series of bills through our reentry initiative. Cindy, you helped us work on them, I think, when Kevin Cameron was a state rep. And one of them, and it didn't go anywhere, but it was the idea that you have veterans preference points and that maybe you could have reentry points, not to make it so that people who have committed crimes have a higher standing, but to level the playing field up. You know, that was kind of the idea. But the body was not ready for that point of view, and we went before a committee, and there were some really terse comments that were made, and one of them that was made to me was, so what are you doing in Marion County about this? And so I didn't really know, and so I went back to our HR person at the time, and I said, what do we do? And she said, well, you know, it really depends on the position and the person, and so we have some folks in the health department that actually we prefer people to have a background in addiction because they're working with people, and then we have other positions in Marion County where we're not, you know, they have like law enforcement where we can't have someone there. So that's what I told everybody after that. But we've had 3 HR managers since this person, and so we had a recent hiring in our board office actually where a young woman was applying and had a criminal background and was screened out by our HR people as not being appropriate because of her arrest record. And that's where I learned about arrest records, because they look really scary, and what people get convicted of is not quite as scary, and there's always kind of more extenuating circumstances. But when HR people go in and they do that background check, they see every crime that the person was charged with. And so Kevin and I intervened, and you know, Sam joined in, and we actually turned that around. But I think if it hadn't been in the board office and we hadn't have gotten involved, it would have been a different outcome. So there's even in our, you know, when you have turnover and people have kind of preset ideas about how things ought to work, and you think things are going along like this, but they're really going along like that, you know, it's a problem.
Thank you, Paul. I was just going to suggest that Dave's Killer Bread has hosted a couple of second chance summits. Mm-hmm. And
the last one was great.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they are partnering with the Governor's Reentry Council business team on a lot of their efforts and sharing much of the work that they're doing around videos and employer education and helping employers understand what is and isn't true with regard to insurance coverage, taking appropriate risks, et cetera. So I apologize that Gina, I'm sorry she couldn't be here today, yeah. But that may be a worthwhile conversation to look at what they're doing under the foundation and in partnership with the Reentry Council that would
No, that's a very good idea. I think that, you know, this really is a rich area to pursue, this mm-hmm. lead by example of mm-hmm. the, you know, just so we don't find ourselves in the position that right. you were in, Janet, in that hearing. Yeah. We should not be in that position. We should be, in fact, leading by example. So anybody's ideas around that would really, I'd really appreciate. Yeah, Paul.
To follow up on Cindy's comments, I serve on the foundation, basically the World Foundation, and we have a meeting this morning, and they are getting ready to roll out a playbook that really is going to be a model for what they hope to be second-chance employers around the state who really try and champion this issue. And this is actually a couple of things I want to bring up. Arrest records are big. 27% of the population in this country now has an arrest record. So that means one in four people that are applying for jobs, that if they're screening for arrest, in addition to convictions, are going to pop up on some HR person's screen. So a lot more people are impacted by this than just the people coming out of prison. And people with convictions, it's a lifelong struggle. And we absolutely need to do more than just pass the policy. I mean, I think what we saw in the city of Eugene when we passed Bandbox right after Multnomah County did was that it was a great policy, but there was no real follow-through effort. And so there wasn't anybody that was really championing the issue at local government saying, hey, look, what we're doing here in the city of Eugene, this is what should be done in the private sector. And so I think as we have this new policy, I think you're absolutely right in figuring out ways to kind of get in there and lead by example. It's going to be probably more helpful than anything else we can do.
So we're running towards the end of our time, and I did want to ask you about the Corrections Industries program. What is the status of that?
Corrections Enterprises?
Enterprises, uh-huh. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So they have operations in a number of our institutions.
I should know the exact number, but I'm going to just say six or so.
Yeah.
I think about 1,400.
About 1,400 inmates, mm-hmm. Yes, in a variety of industries, and are ever looking at ways to add industry options and to keep up with the times. Mm-hmm. I believe from your first meeting, you were perhaps hoping to have more information from OCE specifically.
I suppose we should look at that. I mean, that's an important part of this, mm-hmm. isn't it?
And they have, OCE does some of their own certifications, right. So as part of an internal training process, but they're also looking for ways of improving their kind of industry-recognized certification and have actually partnered with us in education and training on our BOLI training program. So they come under our joint training committee, and now they can offer the same welding and custodial training programs through our committee. So they are always looking for ways as well of expanding opportunities.
Mm-hmm. And are they, that's something I've sort of always tried to wrap my head around. Are they directly a part of a state agency? Because, of course, we don't get a budget for them, so they're sort of their own thing. And are they for-profit or non-profit, or, I mean, what's that model?
They are a quasi-state agency, is that the technical term? Semi-independent state agency. So they have a dotted line to Director Peters. Mm-hmm. They are completely self-funded.
Right.
So I don't know that they fall under, again, the quasi-state agency or semi-independent state agency is their classification versus a nonprofit or a for-profit, mm-hmm. because they are still considered state employees. OCE employees are state employees, but they don't get any general fund money. And again, the dotted line reporting to the director of the Department of Corrections. They aren't an official branch, but they are
because they mm-hmm. operate within right. the facilities.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like an odd model, no? I mean, is it something that works? Is it? Mm-hmm. I mean, does it make sense to not have the two programs integrated more closely?
Actually, I would suggest that we ask them to mm-hmm. provide you an overview and to better explain how it operates and why it operates the way it does, because in part it is the department's requirements to meet Measure 17, and they are a piece of that. So the inmates must work or be going through education for 40 hours.
And the other piece I would say is OCE... I work a lot with OCE. They're, again, they work very hard to be partnering with us. We're looking for I'm currently working with them to explore an option where I'm providing a work-based education program that they can then do a production component to, so that not only are they getting the certification, but then they're funneling into some actual work where they're getting job experience and then can release into the community. So while they operate independently, they are also our partners in lockstep. They also had a representative on the Education Governor's Reentry Council education team, and we work a lot together to try and share resources where applicable and make sure we're not duplicating efforts and finding ways that we can really partner and make each other stronger.
Do we have insight at all, though? Like, I mean, I'd be curious to see, like, how much money do they generate, and how does that translate into, you know, support and services for the inmates doing the work? And do those folks actually, you know, go out? Do we have any? Are we requiring that they collect some data on how successful their programs inside translate to employment outside? I mean, I've got a lot of questions about them and what they do, and
they would be able to speak with them. Yes, yeah,
they've got good reports. I've seen them before.
And they
collect
have
a lot of information.
They do a lot. Many of their businesses don't make money. It actually costs a tremendous amount of money. So they have some businesses that make money, and those businesses actually support these others where they're getting skills, where OCE is not necessarily generating revenue. Actually, they're generating losses. But those individuals that are working there are getting great skills. They're learning trades. They're learning. Mm-hmm. So they're always walking the fine line of needing to make sure that they can support their own agency, mm-hmm. but providing benefit to those who work for them as well.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you very much, both
thank
of you.
You. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm sure we'll call on you again.
Say something real quick before we close, and that is, Cindy started out by talking about how the partnerships are strong, and I just want to tell her and all of you how much I appreciate the partnership with Marion County. I mean, Cindy has been to an enormous number of meetings and think tanks, and anytime I have a question, I email her or need a letter of support or whatever, and so, I mean, when she says that, it's really true. They do a great job.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Anything else for the good of the order for today? All right, great. Then we'll see one another perhaps on Wednesday, the 16th of March, or not. We'll know for sure very soon. Okay, well, great. Well, with that, I'm going to close this meeting, this hearing. Meeting, this hearing. Close this.